Okay, I'm here with Rebecca Cowell, May 9th, Saturday afternoon, and she does freelance journalism, and she's been doing interviews with me about my life history and experiences here in the Freedom Movement in Chapel Hill. So we've done two already, but we didn't record them, and she's got notes on those. And so this is our third interview, and I don't know what she wants to talk about, but I'm ready, whatever it is.
All right. My first question was how you came to get the nickname of Yanni, which is sort of a broad question, right?
But no, it's a very specific question. It's broad in the sense of how does anybody get a nickname?
How does it relate to all of this? But I was interested in that as I was writing some of my notes up. I thought, well, that's a unique nickname. How did that happen?
And it's interesting, too. I mean, just from a Chapel Hill point of view, when I started doing interviews about the civil rights movement, I would often mention somebody's name, and the person would say, who? Oh, you mean Charlie One? Or you mean T.T.? Or you mean Pookie? So I came to realize that just about all black people, at least during that generation, maybe still today, have had nicknames that everybody knew them by. And I don't think that was as common when I was growing up, at least among white kids. And I got this nickname. There's a technical explanation and there's my sort of speculation. Mm-hmm. But my formal name, my name on my birth certificate is John Kenyon Chapman. K-E-N-Y-O-N. And Kenyon is a family name. Comes from like Lucy Kenyon and some other ancestors, and there's a connection with Kenyon College in Gambier, Ohio. And one of my distant relatives was the Dean Bexley at Kenyon College. But so my middle name was Kenyon, and my first name was John, and I was adopted when I was 11 months old, so there was a question of, well, what's your name going to be? This is where my speculation comes in. And at some point, I have a photograph, probably about the time I got adopted, that my adoptive mother sent out to friends or something, and it says, this is our little Johnny. And I think that she decided to change that to Yanni because John was also the name that my birth mother gave me. I think it was something like John Joseph or something like that. And so Johnny might have been what I was used to, might have been what I was called before I was adopted. And Yanni is not so different from that it would probably cause me some trauma.
Right.
But my mother was also very much of a powerful individual. And so the idea of having a nickname that would be very distinctive, I think probably appealed to her.
Very interested, and it sounds like she also wanted to signify the change from.
That's my speculation.
I didn't realize I had not known that you were adopted from our earlier conversations, which makes me wonder your awareness. Do you think there was something that you were born with that you talk about your family, the society, you know, what what was going on with them and how you got reached that age and you were somewhat separate. And mm-hmm. like, you know, noticing things, being aware.
Well, there's undoubtedly important things that impacted my way of being and my awareness and all those things that did have to do probably fundamentally with my adoption
right.
and with those first 11 months and the transition to a new family.
Right.
I have no doubt that those are very important things. It's it is, again, it's sort of speculation to try to understand what those might be.
Right.
But I can tell you that the situation that I was born into was a situation of single motherhood and poverty. Mm-hmm. And my mother lived at the local YWCA. In the city where I grew up, and she was a telephone operator, at least part-time, and she had come from a fairly well-to-do family, but she had basically been expelled from the household when she decided to have me, and she was 17 years old.
Did you have a later relationship with her? You did.
Yeah, I found out more about her and went and met her after my adoptive mother died in 1985. So I did develop a relationship with her. But that hasn't lasted. I think those things are sort of difficult. I mean, I think it's good that I met her.
Right.
I found out a lot of things.
But it's still challenging.
It's very challenging, and not just for me, but also for her.
Right.
And she was also a schizophrenic. And so and she was already a schizophrenic, I'm sure, when she had me. So, you know, she sometimes was there and sometimes wasn't there on an emotional level. And I lived with a foster home during the week. I lived with some older people in a foster home. And then I was with her on weekends at the YWCA. And she would, you know, take me to the zoo and the park and
like
play
that.
Games and, you know, I think she was a very attentive mother, but she didn't have resources, and eventually she sort of against her desires gave me up for adoption.
Must have been a very difficult decision.
I'm sure it was a difficult decision, and partly she thought that she would be able to continue to have contact with me, and then after 6 months she found out, after the adoption was complete, finalized, legalized, she found out she wouldn't be able to have any contact.
Is that why you waited until your adopted mother's death to contact your birth mother, because of that?
No, I actually didn't know how to contact my birth mother.
Right.
I knew her nickname.
Which was?
Bo Peep.
Oh, wow.
I often wonder. See, that nickname came to her and her siblings. They all had nicknames.
Right.
But it came to her when she was little. But it's so ironic that it was Bo Peep, and little Bo Peep lost her sheep, you know.
That's powerful. Life is better than fiction.
Just remember to speak up and talk into your notebook.
Okay, sorry.
So
the that?
Well, no. So she stayed in contact with my birth mother, even though she couldn't have contact with me. Mm-hmm. And I think occasionally got updates and
right.
so on and so forth. But my birth mother was very much opposed to me having any contact with her.
Right.
And so I never even thought of doing it while she was alive.
Right.
But when she died, I think what happened was that she sent a birthday card or some kind of letter, and it got returned saying, this person doesn't live here anymore. And so she figured out that my mother had died, and she sent a letter again to my mother at the same address and said, you know, I'm Yanni's birth mother, and I've decided that I want to leave him all of my worldly possessions and my estate.
Wow.
And the executor of the estate came to me and said, well, there's a letter here that came to us. We've been getting the mail since we're the executors.
Right.
He was a family friend, a lawyer. And I think you should see this. And so he gave me this letter, and she had told me how to contact her in the letter. Mm-hmm. And it was such a trickster move on her part, because she was basically this woman living in abject poverty.
Right.
And she got the, she was smart enough to, I think she was very sharp, and she was smart enough to understand that this might, you know, get some lawyer or executor or something
to pay
attention, or me.
Do you have any siblings with the adoptive family, or your birth mother? Do you have any other siblings that you are aware of?
I've got a half sister from my birth mother.
But none with your adoptive family?
No, because my parents, when they adopted me, they weren't planning on having children. They were 49 and 48 years old. And they didn't have any more children. They didn't adopt anybody else or anything like that. There's lots of details I could go into about this, but
right.
I don't necessarily think it's that important for
the rest of the story.
The rest of the story.
Exactly.
But, you know, you can understand that if someone in their first year doesn't establish, I forget what they call it, but it's a constancy kind of thing.
Attachment and bonding.
Attachment, bonding, all of that. And that would have been a problem for me, probably, because I was going back and forth between the foster home and my mother all the time. And then all of a sudden, to be separated from everything I had grown up with for the first 11 months, and my mother in particular, who I undoubtedly had bonded with in certain ways. And then just to be all of a sudden with somebody else who was older, who wasn't the same kind of sort of young, nurturing kind of parent. And no matter what my adoptive mother and father would have been, it still wouldn't have changed anything that I had basically experienced the death of my mother and the person who provided for me.
Yes.
Or at least I had experienced abandonment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just whatever that whole experience is, part of it is that I felt the need to protest.
And that's what I was fascinated with whenever I got you going on about the adopted and the birth mother and the adopted family. That's a very big key. So something about it.
Something about that old experience just demanded that I protest. It demanded some other things too. Like, at least in my situation, like I try to be in control of my situation.
Right.
And I, the way I did that was by always trying to be the leader. And I had certain physical and social characteristics that enabled me to do that.
Exactly.
But it wasn't always a positive thing. But then as I grew up in this household of people who were my mother and father, but they were the ages of the grandparents of my other friends. My mother in particular was very domineering and attuned to social standards.
Mm-hmm.
And she very much expected me and wanted me to conform to her standards.
Right.
And abide by her judgment. And increasingly I rebelled against that. You know, probably by the time I started getting, certainly by ninth grade, probably my guess is by eighth or seventh grade.
Right. And then around that time is when you went on the trip with the youth group out west.
That was a little bit later. That was the summer before my senior year in high school.
That was in 63.
63?
Yeah. I think that's what we had when you went to South Dakota. So that was a little bit later, but those were sorts of events that were happening.
I graduated in June of 65.
Okay.
And so it would have been the summer of 64 that I went out west. But my huge revolt against my mother's control,
right,
came about by ninth grade.
To ask you a little bit about your involvement at Harvard in the Black Student Movement, which I think you said was more towards the end of your time at Harvard that you became, in what capacity were you involved in?
I was not involved in the Black Student Movement at all.
Okay.
There was a small group of Black students at Harvard. Maybe out of 14,000, I don't know, hundreds. And it happened that I knew one of them.
Okay.
From Cleveland. And we occasionally talked.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't even know there was a Black student movement when I was at Harvard until the political things developed.
Right.
And so what I was involved in, I was standing on the sidelines but getting increasingly more interested and concerned in 1967 and 68 when there were big protests at Harvard against the Vietnam War. And there also started to be protests against what was called university expansion, which was they were the biggest property owner in Cambridge, and they were about tearing down a lot of low-income housing that was where the people, the renters, were often people of color or low-income white workers, and they were going to build a medical center on top of this community. And so there was people in the Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, which until late 68 at least, I had sort of thought of as a fringe group and hadn't been to their meetings or anything. But there were people within that who were doing things that did make sense to me. And it was not only opposition to the Vietnam War, which on a personal level I had educated myself about, and, you know, initially I supported the war, probably. I certainly didn't know enough to really oppose it.
Right.
But during the 60s in college, I educated myself, and there were a lot of teach-ins, and there was documentary movies.
Mm-hmm.
That totally convinced me that this was an unjust war, and even that it wasn't just a mistake, that it was a conscious policy of empire. And it was cloaked in anti-communism, but it was really more about the U.S. having domination of that region and mm-hmm. having security for its interests in that region. So I came to those conclusions, but I didn't really get involved. And there was another aspect of what these SDS students and anti-war students were doing. Some of them were also involved in the local community, and they were fighting this gentrification thing that Harvard was doing. And the slogan that got developed for that was Stop Harvard Expansion.
Mm-hmm.
So, because Harvard was at one end of Cambridge and MIT was at the other end, and they were just sort of gobbling up all the land in between and forcing the traditional neighborhoods out.
And we haven't seen that happen anywhere else, have we?
No, except everywhere.
Exactly.
And particularly in Chapel Hill.
Yes.
Same old story.
Uh-huh.
But I was attracted to that, and I started trying to find out more about what was going on in the community.
Right.
But all of the people that I was talking to were white, except for this one black friend. And he wasn't someone I talked to all that much. But the very few interactions I did have with him were probably among my biggest educations at Harvard. 'Cause he just told me things that I would have never even thought about.
Oh, wow. So you graduated in 69 with a degree in history.
Yeah, I graduated in the spring of 69. And it was in the spring of 69 that we had the big strike. And that's where I found out about the Black Student Movement, because the Black Student Movement, after the SDS put forward its demands and occupied a building, then the Black students put forward their demands, and I can't remember if they occupied a building or not, but they had a list of demands that included a variety of things, including Black studies and I wish I could remember more. It just shows you how uninvolved I was that I don't.
Right.
But those demands became part of the strike.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the strike in the spring of 69, I became part of this SDS group called the Worker Student Alliance, which was led by one of these new Maoist organizations called Progressive Labor Party that had split off from the Communist Party of the United States over the split between the Soviet Union and China,
right,
which had unfolded, you know, during the 60s. And they were promoting the idea of the workers as the leading force for change in the United States, which, you know, I really had to come to slowly because I couldn't see that.
And that, so you graduated spring of 69. When did you begin working in the kitchens?
I began working in the kitchens that summer, I think. Well, actually, over the summer, I remember I worked with the Worker Student Alliance people, and we did strike support. There was a big General Electric strike that we, actually that might have been in the winter after 69. But before that, we we supported a strike and walked a picket line with the, I think it was the Salvation Army workers. Because they were, you know, basically the people that worked for Salvation Army, except for the drivers of their vehicles, were all disabled in some way or another.
Interesting.
And the federal government subsidized their wages so that the Salvation Army was able to pay them less than minimum wage. And the federal government, I think, brought them up to minimum wage. But they believed that they were being exploited and mistreated in a whole variety of ways. And they went on strike along with the drivers, who were mostly black. And so that was actually my first experience of a labor struggle, my first experience talking with workers. And then after that summer, I got a job in the kitchens at Harvard,
right,
as part of the Worker Student Alliance.
And you're washing dishes, peeling potatoes, something along
those Actually, lines. They had me in a slightly more privileged job as I look back on it. There were tunnels underneath all of the dormitories in Harvard. And each dorm had their own cafeteria, but there was a central kitchen. And so they had these little, like, electric cars that pulled this little trainload of stainless steel trays that were full of food trays.
Right.
Or food, I guess. Not food trays, but, you know, large servings of food.
Mm-hmm.
And my job was to drive these this little train around to the different cafeterias.
And deliver the food.
And deliver the food. And I think it was also my job, unless I'm getting confused with my job in Georgia, to clean the stainless steel little cars with high-pressure steam. And so one of the advantages of that job was I got around all over the place. So I got to know the cooks and the serving women and different people. And the whole idea of the Worker Student Alliance was for students like myself, former students, to actually get to know workers and form some kind of solidarity. And there were a couple of workers, in particular a black cook, meat cutter, and a white cook who was a former inmate who had been a hitman for the mafia. And the other cook, the black cook, had grown up in Panama and had been part of the revolts that they had had down there against the U.S. occupation.
Oh, wow.
So by talking to these folks and meeting with them and talking about conditions as workers at Harvard, I gained insight that I would have never in the world had before. And it was broader than just, you know, Harvard. It was like Panama and, you know, Boston, and they were both brilliant people, and
this life experience, you were getting their working class.
Yes.
Experience.
I was learning about that, and I was learning. One of the things that we tried to learn was, what do things look like from the point of view of workers? You know, we're used to looking at things from a privileged position as Harvard students. What do things look like from the point of view of workers? And to what extent can you put yourself in their shoes and take a stand of solidarity with them? So part of it was learning to understand those kinds of dynamics and issues. And
that is what you spent the next over a decade doing. And before you got involved with the housekeepers.
As
a spokesperson for them.
Well, I wasn't really a spokesperson for the housekeepers. I was more like their historian.
Alma Shirley really talked about how you, as the key witness, were able to completely turn the lawyers opposing the housekeepers, could turn their view around. And he says it was a very powerful. You have to document the.
I've got the deposition that Tom Zyko took, who was the state district attorney. I'd have to find it, but I don't think I turned him around. There may have been other lawyers and other people who were learning about the history of UNC's treatment of black workers and the history of workers organizing, who I did help turn around.
Right.
I think Tom Zyko was a lost cause, but what did happen was that probably in a burst of a couple of hours, Tom Zyko realized that we had a powerful story to tell about the history of white supremacy, slavery, institutional racism, the long history of this and the long history of organizing against it. And we had data and we had concrete evidence and we had a witness who could speak on this with the authority of a historian.
Right.
And so I think that may have helped turn them toward agreeing to a settlement rather than going through a public trial.
Where this would be on the front page of the NNO every day of trial.
That's right. And I think that's probably what Al was getting at.
Which is in some ways sad that it didn't get to be presented to the public.
I was sad, and I think Al was sad, but on the other hand, the housekeepers had been struggling for year after year after year. And sometimes, you know, it was up to them how to proceed.
Right. So it was time for them to get.
And you know, this settlement offered them something substantial. It was either that or potentially get the whole lawsuit thrown out at some point or lose it. You'd have to deal with the power of the university and the lawyers and all that. And the other thing is that the struggle would have dragged on. Of course, it dragged on anyways, but sometimes it's good to settle.
And you do lose momentum.
Yeah, you know, people get worn out, especially when they're working two or three jobs and taking care of a family and, you know, all of that. So it wasn't really up to me or Al whether to go forward with this thing and not accept the settlement that was offered. But I think the university did have to offer a somewhat substantial settlement.
Mm-hmm.
They certainly didn't want to face that kind of publicity.
No. They didn't appreciate the publicity that came with the Cornelia Spencer belt.
No, they really didn't appreciate that either.
And that was a much smaller scale compared to the housekeepers.
Right. It was small but volatile because she was such a well-known historical figure
right. In
the state. But the housekeepers thing would have been on a much bigger scale and had the potential. I mean, you think if it's in the newspapers statewide, then workers at all the other universities are knowing about it. If they can do it in Chapel Hill, maybe we can do it at NC State. You know,
right.
There's a tremendous potential there for the movement to grow.
Right. And as coming at this later as a historian, after being being involved in the grassroots, which is where you were for years, and then you brought your drive and passion and focus to the historical part of this. So, I mean, I know now that you have your dissertation, you have the thesis, you have all of this information. Is it moving forward in any ways in this community? Do you feel that?
I think it is. I think that over all these years, we have accumulated a knowledge base that's very powerful. And other people know about it besides just me.
Right.
But one of my focuses at this point is that knowledge base needs to get passed on in a more systematic way to other people. So if I can't be here to carry on that work, others can carry it on effectively.
Do you have help? Like putting that plan or getting more people involved, or is it just in having the conversations with me or CJ or
no,
Haley?
It's a much bigger thing than just those individual conversations.
Right.
At this point, nobody else is doing autobiographical interviews with me other than you. People have talked about doing that. Faculty at the university and some of the folks in the NAACP. We haven't done that yet. We may still do that.
Right. But there's that time thing, right?
Yeah, I have the potential for major surgery coming up in 2 months. And I have limited energy because of my health situation.
Right.
So I feel a tremendous press in terms of time.
Right.
But the individual meetings that I have with you or with CJ or with other people are more part of the organizing work that you need to do. You can't just call meetings and do programs and stuff like that. You know, the relationships have to be more individual and substantial.
Right.
And so for years now, I've been working with the NAACP History Committee.
Right.
And so we have done a variety of things, mostly this Freedom Rider marker that we did recently.
I spoke to Dr. Kleinman.
Cheryl Kleinman,
and she had said that you were, she said your commitment and efforts in working for justice, especially in racial justice, over the long haul are unequaled. And she said that you have brought historical truth to UNC Chapel Hill and the town, not only by documenting racism, but also by bringing people together to recognize and celebrate the contributions of black people. And she said that the Freedom Riders was a huge thing that... she said, I'm sure everybody else is talking about the Cornelia Spencer Bell, but for her, she said that the Freedom Riders was a more significant in a different way.
Well, the Freedom Riders was beyond the university. It included the university, and it was one of the very few opportunities that black people in Chapel Hill have had a chance for their history to become known and for them to voice their own history and to learn it even. I mean, most people didn't know who lived here in 1947, didn't even know about this Freedom Ride. But, you know, when you put it together with all the other things that happened that I've written about,
right?
And frankly, I didn't know about it even after I wrote my dissertation.
Oh,
you know, I found out about it several years ago because it just wasn't a big part of any of the local histories or people's memory.
So these markers, and that is what's really important to Chapel Hill, in the history is putting up these markers or pulling out those pieces of the history and making them public, and that's what you have been doing.
Yeah, and that's what we want to do on a more comprehensive scale in the schools, in the curriculum, in commemorative public art at the schools, in the town, at the university. And so the Freedom Rider, just to say, one of the really important things about the Freedom Rider highway marker is that it is the only marker that really acknowledges that there was Jim Crow in Chapel Hill and that people fought it.
Wow.
You could say that there are some other public monuments to that. For instance, the Unsung Founders Monument at UNC touches on that. But it acknowledges the labor of slaves and black workers, but it doesn't really acknowledge their freedom struggle. And it doesn't acknowledge the slavery. I mean, it does acknowledge slavery, but it doesn't acknowledge the whole long history of institutional racism, of slavery and white supremacy and Jim Crow. It's not explicit. In fact, you would never even know what that monument was. Unlike big old Silent Sam, that you know is a Confederate monument,
right,
if you pay attention.
Oh.
Or the Choo Choo Justice statue down at the stadium.
Right, right.
You know exactly what those things are honoring, in a sense, even if you don't know the history. But the Unsung Founders is not very clear, and it's one of the weaknesses of it. It's not particularly educational.
Right, right. So getting that information into the schools and into North Carolina history, like the curriculum.
Right.
Do you have people you're working with, or how does that trickle down? You've got this dissertation, this thesis, you've got your work up here at UNC.
Yeah, so far, the way that has, I don't necessarily like the term trickle down because it reminds me of Ronald Reagan.
Oh, sorry.
But
way before my
time. He was the sponsor of trickle down economics, that, you know, you boost up the elite with subsidies and lower taxes and all this kind of thing, and it'll trickle down to the rest of the population.
So how does your information reach the public school system,
right,
reach curriculum?
So that is in the process of growing,
right,
I would say, particularly since the Bell Award struggle.
Right.
Because when we did the Bell Award struggle on campus, we had an organized group called CHAT, the Campaign for Historical Accuracy and Truth. And we publicized an awful lot about university history, and there was a whole symposium that the university sponsored on this, and things came out of that, like the university's virtual museum.
Right.
Which, you know, they don't publicly acknowledge me, but they do publicly acknowledge that it came out of this symposium in response to the critique of the Bell Award.
That's what I find really interesting as I have been doing research and reading online. You are the graduate student, Yanni, but your actual contributions are not being recognized. And even having had this little email thing going on with David Klein, it interests me. It makes me wonder why, you know, are they afraid of...
It's part of the university's institutional culture, in my opinion. People in South Building, you know, which is the administration building, didn't really like it that I stirred up the waters about Cornelia Phillips Spencer. and expose this history. They had to respond because of the power of what we did.
Mm-hmm.
And the evidence that we had collected.
Right.
And yet they responded in a very cautious, piecemeal, half-hearted way, in mm-hmm. my opinion. The Chancellor did sponsor this symposium, but initially it really wasn't going to include any kind of people from the community or black students or anything like that. It was just set up to be a symposium of scholars who would then, based on their testimony, supposedly that was going to stimulate a community conversation about the history of the university.
But it's so alienating to the actual community members
who
aren't academics or don't have access into that.
So it was only because of the efforts of myself and Chat that, actually, I don't even think Chat was a formal organization then, but we did have the campaign for a moratorium on the Bell Award. And it was only because of our efforts and our direct intervention with Harry Watson of Center for the Study of the American South, we demanded that there be a broader representation on the panels and so forth,
mm-hmm.
and that it be framed less as an academic conference and more as a dialogue with the community.
Right.
So, you know, again, that's the kind of thing that the administrators in South Building don't really want to admit that it wasn't going to be a democratic process to begin with, and that it required the intervention of people who were resisting
mm-hmm.
the mainstream culture to change that. And then the major thing that came out of it from the point of view of the university was that Chancellor Meeser, you know, Chancellor Meeser was not a Southerner. Well, he may have been a little bit of a Southerner. I think maybe he was from Oklahoma.
I have to look it up. I can't remember right off the top of my head.
He might have been from a Southern state, but not deep South, not North Carolina for sure. And he wasn't connected with UNC. So I think he was probably sincerely shocked by some of this history.
Mm-hmm.
As were, I'm sure, many other people at the university who basically were appalled at the amount of at the history of the university that had not been acknowledged openly.
Right.
And so the idea that the university had consistently put a glamorous spin on its history and avoided any kind of admission of promoting injustice, for some people that really made a big difference. Chancellor Meeser handled it like a politician, and he basically said, it is our obligation as an institution of learning to acknowledge our complete history, warts and all.
Right.
Warts and all is,
uh-huh.
is his phrase.
Exactly.
And unfortunately, that way of framing the history, warts and all, implies that you have a basically healthy person or image.
With just a little flaw.
With a few flaws,
uh-huh.
you know, with a little wart here and there.
Right.
And in fact, the history of the university is very clear once you study it a little bit, that the university was the leading state institution in terms of promoting slavery, the leading state institution in terms of promoting white supremacy, and a consistent upholder of Jim Crow and a resister against the civil rights movement for desegregation of higher education, and the main institution in Chapel Hill that could have impacted in a positive way the civil rights struggle, but the university chose to remain on the sidelines because for whatever reasons. You know, it was too risky, you know, from the point of view of the state politicians and the trustees and so forth, and because a lot of them were racist.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they didn't have black trustees and black politicians at that time. So they actually did a lot of damage, because the movement would have been much more powerful if all the black workers who worked at UNC in the hospital had felt safe to participate in the movement.
Right.
But in any case, getting back to the university's response and who I've got that I'm working with to carry on this history, the university established this virtual museum, which was supposed to represent the history of the university, warts and all. And it is exactly what you would expect from a museum. It's sort of an eclectic collection of anecdotes and history. But what it isn't is an analytical narrative of the that includes the university's sponsorship of institutional racism throughout its history. And that's a fundamental fact that the university has thus far refused to acknowledge.
Which is institutional racism.
That's institutional racism. I mean, slavery was institutional racism.
Right.
Jim Crow was institutional racism. But we have a form of institutional racism today that is more disguised. It's more subtle, not particularly for the workers, but certainly because we have such diversity in the student body and to some extent in the faculty and administration, it's camouflaged because people are trained in our society not to see the workers.
Right.
They're invisible.
And we still have Silent Sam sitting up there.
We have Silent Sam with a tremendous constituency that would oppose any effort to move or remove Silent Sam, that stands as a testimony, in my opinion, that the university refuses to take a really strong anti-racist stand in today's world.
So as long as they continue, as long as he's still there, then there's all of these undercurrents going on, these subtle, it's not fully exposed if you can't. If you can't remove these symbols, or these...
I don't necessarily think that everything needs to be removed. Like, I'm not in favor of changing the names of all the older buildings on campus. But I do think an honest history that includes the white supremacy of the namesakes of those buildings needs to be public. Yes, a placard on the building. You know, a fairly concise kind of thing in the university's online history.
Mm-hmm. Is there a walking map? I know there were.
There is a walking map that is done by the, maybe it's the UNC Visitors Bureau or something like that.
Right.
I think you pick it up in Jackson Hall, which is, you know, where applicants come.
Does it have the true history on? Or is it, has that been revisited?
That has been revisited a little bit, and I'm not up to speed on what the walking map has, and there's an audio walking tour thing that goes along with the walking map, and I'm not clear how much of the university's true history has been incorporated. I don't think it's very much. I've listened to the tour guides as they take groups around, and I've heard black tour guides hit on this stuff pretty accurately, but I've never heard white tour guides hit on it accurately.
Interesting.
And I don't think it's anything that has been, you know, very persistently attempted, or a revision has been very seriously attempted. Now, students at the Campus Y a number of years ago, I think when Derwin DuBose was the president, developed a Black History walking tour, which they tried to have promoted at the Visitor Center. And that may still be there, or not. I don't really know. I don't think they had real institutional backing for that. And there's also regular Black History tours that Professor Tim McMillan, who's one of the professors in African American history, he's taken that on as a special contribution. And so he does these walking tours where he explains the true history of the university and uses the buildings and the monuments to illustrate that. And they're very educational and very provocative. And they're somewhat institutionalized at this point. I mean, they're not officially sponsored by the university, but I think that the Preservation Society and the Orange County Visitors Bureau have promoted this to some extent. And certainly other professors can say, you need to go on Tim McMillan's Black History Walking Tour, or the BSM can tell its membership, go on Tim McMillan's Black History Walking Tour, you'll learn a lot. So that's one of the things that sort of started to happen. A number of professors are starting to incorporate this newly available local and university history into their courses.
Oh, good. So the dissertation that...
Yeah, my dissertation and my thesis have both been used in courses.
Oh, good.
Jacqueline Hall used my thesis in her course on the desegregation of the Chapel Hill schools. A professor named Kurzman, who teaches sociology, I forget his first name, he's taught part of my dissertation and invited me to the class. Della Pollock does a lot with the history of the North Side community. Some graduate students sometimes use these resources. Michal, who is a graduate student in, I think, anthropology, teaches a course that incorporates this local history. Cheryl Kleinman probably does it some in some of her classes. And in particular, there was, but is no longer, a wonderful class taught by Sandy Darity, who is now at Duke.
Oh.
And Sandy Darity is the son of the first Black professional graduate from UNC. And he's an economist, a world-famous economist. But he's very interested in the history of the Black presence at the university. And so he had a course that was a year-long course that actually students received a stipend for doing it, and it was a research course. And they would take different aspects of UNC's Black history, or the Black presence at UNC, and they would develop research on these topics, and then they'd pull them together and have a class presentation to the public about them. And this went on for about 2 or 3 years until he left.
So he's using resources, available resources to do research and,
yeah,
and gather.
Yeah, and I won't say that, you know, he was someone directly working with me, but I think the work that I've done has created an environment at UNC where it's not only okay to do this kind of teaching and research, but it's also easier than it would have been in the past, because the resources have been identified. And actually there's been things that I've written that can be used. People don't have to go through and dredge through the university archives and find this stuff from scratch.
That's something I was really thinking about. That is part of your legacy with what the work you've done up here at UNC, is that you did create an environment where it was okay, because you put those first few documents out, and now it just gets built upon. and mm-hmm. the right people take it.
Well, I won't say it now, it just gets built upon. Mm-hmm. I mean, I try to organize it to make it happen right. as much as I can. I try to promote these resources as much as I can. When you're doing something for justice, it never just happens.
Right.
It's always a struggle. Mm-hmm. But it is happening.
Tell me a little bit about UNC Now, what they are. Are you involved with them as far as, you know?
I'm on their core member listserv, and I go to some of their meetings. And I'm good friends with a number of the students and community folks who are involved in UNC Now. It's not simply a student organization.
Right. They have a big presence at St. Joseph's. And
yeah. The way UNC Now came about was out of Della Pollitt's course on Northside.
Oh, okay.
And it may be that her course was focused on the gentrification of Northside. I'm not sure about that. But she's taught this course for a couple of years now, and out of this course have come students who wanted to continue doing things. And this was a course that built on direct practice, not only talking or interviewing or research.
Which is what you did, direct practice.
I did both direct practice and the research and writing kind of thing. But my basic thinking is that you don't make any impression at all, or very, very little, with research and writing unless you connect that with practice, with movement building, with fighting for justice around certain specific issues. I mean, if I hadn't done the Cornelia Phillips Spencer organizing, 95% of the people who know about my research would not know about it now.
Right.
And even a larger number would still know nothing about the university's true history. So you have to take a stand on issues. And that is one of the things that Della Pollitt has encouraged in her course. I don't think she's required it at all, but her students have formed a relationship with St. Joseph's Church and the black community that involves solidarity on several levels. You know, one of those levels is service,
mm-hmm.
Where they help with the food program that serves, I think, 350 meals per week or per day or something, some huge amount.
Right.
And another of those things is actually worshiping together. So they actually are members of St. Joseph's Church. I mean, this is not a specifically religious faith. Mm-hmm. group. Mm-hmm. But a number of them attend St. Joseph's and sing in the choir and things like that. But another thing, they are involved in the struggles of the community.
Right.
And in particular, they've been involved with two things. One is saving the community's history and helping to find an institutionalized way to guarantee that. So they have worked with St. Joseph's to help create the Marion Cheek Jackson Center for Making and Saving History, which is going to document not only the church's history, but the community's history.
Right.
And the name implies that they're actually going to do some things too, making history. So that's new, but it's already got a space at St. Joseph's. It's already got equipment. Already got a relationship with the UNC libraries.
That's
so that's very institutionalized. And I'm going to contribute some of my stuff to them where it will be available.
Good.
The other thing they've done is joined with the community in the struggle against gentrification.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, there's been a lot of outrage over Greenbridge, this huge looming development that is going up right across the street from St. Joseph's Church, and that the community was sort of, you know, the way development happens in Chapel Hill, it sort of has its own little behind-the-scenes process.
Mm-hmm.
Developers, bankers, university people, politicians. And it just sort of moves forward without most of the public even knowing what's going on. And that's what happened.
And by the time the public is aware, it's already been put in place. I was recently reading, I guess it was this past Sunday, some of those interviews in the Chapel Hill News.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another side of that process that was not made known to the public.
Right. And, you know, Greenbridge did present itself with a social justice face. But whether they were well-meaning or not, they totally botched it.
Right.
And it was more talk than it was reality. And the community is very upset about it. So students from UNC Now have joined with community members of UNC Now and the NAACP and a variety of other organizations to struggle with that situation. I mean, Greenbridge can't be stopped.
Right.
But the community could still get a lot more out of the construction of Greenbridge that might help save it, save the community, than what the community has gotten so far.
And it's just being, the public is being made aware. With, if there wasn't the struggle going on right now, and if there weren't some of the protesting and things of that nature with UNC Now, we wouldn't know. People that read the paper would not know that there is another side to this development that we see erecting there, being erected there.
And, you know, in addition to some of this historical work I've done in the last year, I joined the town's sustainability committee, which was newly formed. I was one of the original members. And it was formed specifically by the council to reflect equal parts concern with, in terms of sustainability, with the economy, the environment, and social justice. So I'm on there as part of the group advocating for social justice in all of the town's development planning and its solid waste disposal strategies and all of those kinds of things. And it's through the language of sustainability that I think we're now starting to see some of the struggles in the community become more understandable to people who don't understand the black community or racial justice very much, but they do have a sense that sustainability is important. They just didn't realize what an important part social justice was of sustainability. So this is actually a trend that's growing around the world.
It's the buzzword, right?
Sustainable is the buzzword, and so everybody has to present themselves as green. But unfortunately, what green has been narrowed down to mean in the United States in particular is energy efficiency and environmental protection. That's basically what it's come down to. And so everybody who's a developer in Chapel Hill these days has to bow to green and present themselves as green.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, they exclude the social justice aspect.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, Greenbridge acknowledged it more than I think any other developers ever have, but they just didn't follow through properly.
Right.
And so I think there is now a sense that's starting to develop starting to develop in Chapel Hill for the black community to understand that it's always had to respond to these developer initiatives in the past, or town initiatives, and that the only possible sustainable solution for the black community in terms of development is for the black community to speak for itself and put forward its own ideas about what kind of development is needed, what kind of schools are needed, what kind of housing is needed, how to sustain small black businesses that can't compete. You know, this is not just a black problem. Small businesses everywhere can't compete with these big Walmarts and so forth.
Right.
Kmarts, you name it. But black businesses are hurt more simply because black people generally have less capital and less resources than white entrepreneurs. So that's part of institutional racism. That's a historical structure that's been built up over time, so that any policy you have, like equal opportunity in hiring contractors, it still ends up being racist because the black contractors often have, well, setting aside the possibility of current discrimination, which we know there is still a lot of that. But even so, if there were no discrimination, the black contractors often have less resources, less broad experience, you know, less access to technology. You okay?
Yeah. Yes, I'm good.
And so that's just a structure that's been set up historically. And unless you work constantly and clearly against that historical structure to change it and mend it and right the wrongs, then that makes you someone who is a facilitator of institutional racism. Doesn't mean that you're, you know, a Mississippi burning racist.
But it means that you're not aware of.
It means you're not aware.
The history.
You don't care enough. Mm-hmm. You don't know the black community. You know, it means a lot, but you wouldn't want to call every liberal who goes along with traditional development patterns, or who's an administrator at the university, it wouldn't be helpful to call them a racist, in my opinion.
Right.
Because there's a stereotype of what a racist is that doesn't really fit that kind of person. And we have to understand that institutional racism can be promoted by good people if they're not aware, and if they're afraid to really buck the mainstream culture. So, I mean, we were talking about to what extent I have developed people and institutions to carry on this work, and that's what I'm really focusing on now. I'm thinking about doing a class, sort of a teach-in, a series of teach-ins for people about the local history.
Where would those be held?
I would probably try to hold them at Hargraves. I mean, this is an idea that's just being tossed around now.
Right.
So there's really no plan, but passing on this information in a way where other people can carry the work on. I mean, a lot of people can carry the work on in some ways, and there are resources that they can use, but I sort of have put myself in a unique position because of this tremendously long experience of both organizing and academic work, and combining the two, and having experience with challenging institutional racism in the town and the university. That's a very specialized knowledge base and experience that I have. And so I need to find ways to pass that on to the fullest extent possible.
Right.
Also, I should mention, you asked if there was a trend of more honest history being done by the university. Mm-hmm. The university library, particularly the Southern Historical Collection, which is the leader of that department is Tim West. And the University Archives, which is a separate entity, the archivists and the Southern Historical Collection have collaborated. For instance, following this Cornelia Phillips Spencer thing, a little bit after that, they did a research project where they pulled out all the information they could find about the university and slavery. You know, all these quotes from different papers that they have, and quotes from the trustees' minutes, and a lot of material that I had already, but a lot that I didn't. And you know, with a group of archivists working on this, you can accomplish a lot more. I mean, they're skillful. They know the sources. And they put together a booklet, you know, that documents all of this, makes it available. They put together a electronic digital display on the library's website. They put together a physical display at the Southern Historical Collection, and they held some programs in association with this to educate the public. And then they also did that with the 60s protests at UNC, 1960s protests at UNC.
Okay.
And they've done it with other things, and they've got plans to do that kind of work. And it might have happened without the sort of ice-breaking mm-hmm. work that myself and people in chat did at the university, but I think it wouldn't have happened as soon, or it wouldn't have happened in the same way, because, you know, part of the way institutional racism works and the institutional culture that says it's taboo to talk about certain things. It's like surface tension on water or something.
Right.
It's got to be broken by somebody.
Right.
That's what the civil rights sit-ins did in 1960. And it's actually what the Freedom Riders were trying to do in 1947. You know, for people to openly challenge the segregation laws and take the consequences
mm-hmm.
Nonviolently. And the civil rights sit-ins did the same kind of thing on a much more massive and successful scale. And what we did at UNC with the, you know, there were early precursors to this, like there was the Students Seeking Historical Truth that did the decoration of Saunders Hall. There was the efforts of the black student movement in the 1960s to get more black students and black history and all of that. There was the big struggle in the 1990s for a Sonya Haynes Stone freestanding black cultural center.
Mm-hmm.
And there was also the lawsuit that the housekeepers did, which was really a historical and reparations lawsuit that started to popularize these things. But none of these things actually really managed to break the surface tension, I don't think.
Right.
And the Cornelia Phillips Spencer thing did.
And that was
why I always called it a can opener issue.
That's a great thing to call it.
And you know,
because it was finally the thing that it got people's attention.
It really got people's attention because Cornelia Phillips Spencer was such a meaningful icon to so many people for so many different reasons, and her history was not known for the most part. And if it was known, which it certainly was by some of the progressive women who founded the Bell Award,
interesting.
They did know it, but they convinced themselves that it wasn't that important. Mm-hmm. And you see, there again, it's a structural thing. This committee that set up the Bell Award did not include, certainly didn't include any black workers, but it didn't include black faculty.
Right.
Or black students. And, you know, when you set in motion a process with those kind of shortcomings, you're going to end up with a product that has the same kinds of shortcomings. So,
right, right. Well, they didn't erase the history, her history, so it was just always there waiting for the right person to search for it.
That's right. It wasn't the Inquisition where they burned all the records and burned the books. And, you know, some of the southern states have burned all of their civil rights records and stuff.
Really?
I forget which ones, Mississippi or Alabama or somebody.
Oh, wow.
That's what I've heard.
Right.
Don't quote me as a historian.
No, I will look that up. That would be very interesting just to find personally, to read that. And it's fascinating. Yeah, history is...
Tim Tyson would know about that.
Right. Oh, I need to get his email from you.
I can send it to you.
Yeah, do send it to me. I'd love to get some thoughts from him also.
So, I mean, to put it in a nutshell, I do think that we broke the surface tension and started the ball rolling. I certainly wasn't the first one, but I think partly because of the extent of my academic work and my connections in the community through the NAACP and organizing for a variety of reasons that helped this issue break out, and I wasn't nearly as vulnerable to the kind of dismissal and isolation that, say, a graduate student who wasn't part of the community, who was younger, or who hadn't done extensive research, you know, would be. So there was a variety of reasons why this thing was able to break out with my leadership. And I would certainly say that the black students, Christy Booker and the black student movement, also gave a real big push to this with the anti-Klan Declaration of Saunders and some of the work they did, for instance, to get the slave cemetery rehabilitated and get a plaque there. I think the housekeepers made a tremendous difference with that lawsuit where it brought out the history for the first time. And I helped facilitate that. I helped facilitate, you know, what the black students did. But if it hadn't been for them and for their actions and for the kind of support that I had
right.
through the Bell Award campaign, of black faculty and workers and the NAACP and so forth, nothing much would have come of my efforts. So that's important to emphasize. I mean, media people sometimes want to make it out like, oh, Yanni did this, Yanni did that. And there's some truth to that. But if you lose sight of the overall struggle that actually is led by black people, mm-hmm. You don't really understand what I've been able to build on and work with.
You a lone hero figure.
A lone white hero who has saved.
Right, whenever you've actually been working so closely with the community and with key figures and the youth, like the black student movement at UNC. So, no, it's important to recognize that it was a combined effort.
Very important. And often, for whatever reasons, I mean, I think there are sort of storylines that our culture promotes. And we focus on individuals rather than collective social movements.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easier to dismiss something that one person does, and if you happen to be opposed to what that movement is really all about, if you can successfully undermine the reputation of that person, you call them a communist or you call them not professional or whatever, mm-hmm. that can destroy the movement. If the movement allows itself to be right. totally dominated by one person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I see that. That's a very key thing when you're working together and you're not, it's not about you.
Let me pause this here for a minute.
Sure. You know, it's just going back over what I have gathered and making sure that was actually the correct information or the correct memory or the correct story.
That's fine.
Have you worked with Sally Green at all?
Yeah.
Yeah. She gave me some wonderful information, and she said that the usual route is from the PhD to the classroom. Surely most history professors are committed to the idea that studying the past is important to understanding the present and even shaping the future, but Yanni takes this premise directly to the community, which I thought was very... is a great quote, this may be one of my questions before I let you rest, but when you were studying history at Harvard and you were just studying past histories, and did you ever think that you would use history to help?
Yes, that was my purpose.
So when you applied to Harvard and you got in, and you chose history coming out of high school, knowing that that would give you
a skill that I thought could help make the world a better place. And specifically, I probably mentioned this in earlier interviews, I wanted to be a history teacher. And that commitment probably got stronger as I went through Harvard and learned more and more about the real history, the honest history. But I think it had started with my exposure to history through Peter Relic, you know, who was sort of my mentor in high school. I talked about him before, I think.
Right. He got you in the program where you tutored at the house.
Caramu House,
which is still, I looked it up, it is still running strong today.
Yeah. And then that was really strengthened when I went out to the Indian Reservation and realized how much of the history of Indians had been suppressed. But my idea was very different from what I'm doing now. My idea was that I would take history from Harvard and become a history teacher at a high school like the one I had attended. In fact, at the high school I had attended.
So you visualize being like Peter Relic, encouraging young people like yourself.
Right, and in particular that's a vision that includes teaching young people like myself, meaning elite white young people, in a private school setting, information about honest history that would lead to them, I had hoped, being decision makers in society who would make history decisions that were more consistent with justice. And that was my plan, all going through Harvard. And I think I told you before that I actually got offered a job doing that.
I read it actually in your dissertation, the introduction. So you did get a job, and then you went to work in the kitchen, which is a very, very striking difference there.
The basic story of how that happened, which I won't go into in too much detail, I hope. I had gotten very involved in the Harvard strike and in SDS, and I think in June, we were on a bus from Cambridge to Chicago to the big national SDS convention, where there was going to be a big showdown with between the Worker Student Alliance people and the Revolutionary Youth Movement people. And we believed more in the working class, and they didn't seem to. They thought it was more of a youth cultural movement. But it's hard to make that as a totally black and white distinction. They liked the Black Panthers, but they didn't believe in the working class in the same way that we did. But in any case, I went, and I was on this bus, and there was a guy who was in SDS named Peter Belazarian. And I was talking to him during one of the breaks when we got off the bus, and he asked me what I was going to do. And I said, I was going to go back to Hawken and be a teacher and teach labor history and African American history. And he said, oh, so you're going to go back to your privileged background and teach rich kids about this history. And you think that's a more important contribution to the movement than you could make by staying in Cambridge and working with the Worker Student Alliance. And I thought about it. I don't remember when I came to the conclusion, but I thought, well, actually, the way things work is that, you know, there's a movement now, and I need to be part of that.
Right.
This is a moment in time. You know, are you going to stand on the sidelines, or are you going to jump in? And I didn't know what that would lead to. I had no sense of what that would lead to, actually. But I decided, okay, well, the right thing for me to do, the best use of my abilities, is to work with the working class and be an organizer and, you know, transform myself and do this practical work as a community organizer. And so I had to call up my friend Jim Young, who had hired me for the job, and tell him, no, I wasn't going to do it.
And your parents, whenever you say, I'm not going to teach, I'm actually going to go work here at Harvard in the kitchens, or...
I don't even remember the reaction of my parents. I was so independent of my parents at that point that I certainly wouldn't have thought about asking their permission or have had a great concern about what they thought about it.
Right.
But I'm sure that they were upset and disappointed. I mean, they had come to my graduation and had been exceedingly upset by the radicals that I was hanging out with, and by the fact that we walked out of graduation and caused this big brouhaha that was in the national media. And they were just totally upset and mortified.
Right. Did later, did you and your parents come to any understanding or they where they acknowledged what you were doing and your contributions to?
No.
No.
First of all, my dad died. I think about a year after I moved to Atlanta. I think he died in 1972. And it was very sudden. Mm-hmm. So I never got a chance to talk to him. And we hadn't been talking that much anyways.
Right.
Not that I was antagonistic to him, but he was, I think, so upset. He found this not something he was able to talk about.
Right.
And I was not sensitive or wise enough to approach him and talk with him about it in a way that would have been constructive. So he never had much to say about it, but I knew he was upset, and then he died. And my mother, I also knew was upset, and she never came to value the work that I was doing and thought it was a waste of time and I was being self-indulgent. And
that's an interesting word to say, self-indulgent, for someone who's working a blue-collar job, working with.
Well, there were times that in my life that I wasn't working full-time. Mm-hmm. And I remember at one point she said, you know, if your life is ever going to take off, you need to get a responsible job. Mm-hmm. And I think by that time I had been working in the hospital for years with a regular, you know, job, which was like a 7 to 3:30 or something.
Right.
But it wasn't the kind of job she had picked out for me, or the kind of career that she thought was right for me. And, you know, in some ways it turned out that she was right, in the sense that my skills really, at a certain point, the most useful thing for me to do in terms of working for a better world, I decided was going to graduate school and being a professional activist and academic. And I had been unsure of that along the way. You know, I had made two decisions to not be a working class organizer, an activist, community organizer. And one was when I went to NC State for 6 months and got all the science courses I needed to get admitted to the UNC School of Public Health to be a occupational health and safety student master's program. But I decided again, even after I got accepted, which was hard enough, that this probably wasn't the best use of my time. It would be better to continue to do my organizing at the hospital and stick with the working class. And part of that was because I wasn't quite sure how, as an expert in occupational health and safety, what kind of situation that would put me in where I could really do that.
Right.
I might end up being an inspector who went around to different facilities, and the more I learned about that, the less appealing that became as an effective strategy. Well, then I decided, I'll go to medical school, because I already had a medical background, and I it would be a very secure, responsible job, and I thought it was something I could enjoy doing. And so I was thinking seriously about medical school, and I decided against that as well, for the same reasons. So, you know, I did always have the idea of being a history teacher, and I didn't do it the way I thought about doing it originally. Instead, I got a lot of experience doing organizing and doing working class jobs and getting a working class education in technical school, and really changing my life in a lot of ways and my identity and my culture. But I did end up being a teacher in most of the essential ways.
You did.
That's what I've ended up doing. And I think it's just, I'm very happy with the way it developed and worked out. We can end. I don't know what time it is. My back's to the clock.
Yeah, it's almost. I want to talk to you a little bit before I rush out of here.
Yeah, we can stop the interview.
Okay, there you go.